priming in the embryo, which is the process whereby the different compartments of the embryo in the derm, ectoderm, and mesoderm organize themselves. So our definition for today is the structural and or functional adaptation of tissues in response to mechanical and biochemical, and we can go ahead and throw in electrical stimuli as well. So tissue patterning actually occurs not only in the early stages of development, but throughout the lifespan of an organism. So it can occur during normal growth and adaptation. It can occur in cases where tissues are exposed to a pathological stimulus, say cancer, for example, or diabetes. And it can also occur when tissues are trying to recover from such a stimulus during tissue regeneration. So, for example, if you have a wound and the wound heals and a scar forms, that's an example of tissue regeneration. So just to show you some of these pictures, these were all collected either by my lab or by one of my close collaborators in the cell biology department. This is a Xenopus embryo. It should look a little familiar. It's a cross-section of a spherical embryo. And we see that the cells are nicely patterned around this blastocele pore. This is a normal adult microvascular network in the rat. This is taken from the spinal trapezius muscle, which is the muscle on the back of the animal. And the yellow represents an arterial or a small artery, and the red vessels here represent venules, or the smallest veins in our body. This is an example of a cross-section of a vessel wall, a coronary vessel in the heart of a rat. And this is an example of an entire microvascular network, where you can see examples of angiogenesis, which I'm going to talk about in detail later, which is the process of sprouting of new vessels from the existing ones. So here's a sprout right here, and here's another sprout. And these were all obtained using the technique of immunohistochemistry, which is where we take fluorescently labeled antibodies that are specific to proteins in our tissues, and they basically light up those proteins where they're expressed in the tissue. So that's how we can see blood vessels, for example, here and here. So you're going to see a lot of pictures that look like this throughout the talk. So the key problems or the questions in understanding tissue patterning are sort of simply relayed here. What are the key molecular signals involved with giving rise to tissue patterns? How do cells integrate a multitude of signals? Because, of course, it's never just as simple as one signal that's involved with forming those patterns. What role does the environment that the tissue's in play? And how do different stimuli, or for example, different diseases, elicit different tissue patterns? And then finally, the question that's most near and dear to my heart as an engineer is, can we predict and manipulate tissue patterns? For example, when we try to do tissue engineering or create new therapies for regenerative medicine. So today I'm going to talk about our approach to answering, trying to start to answer some of these questions, and that is the use of agent-based models. So I'm just going to go through a quick overview for those of you who may not be familiar with this approach. Basically, we're looking at this system, a dynamic complex system, as if it's composed of many interacting agents. And these agents are discrete or individual. So another name you might have heard for agent-based modeling approach is individual-based modeling approach. So it's that these agents that are interacting both with one another and also with their environment through these very simple sort of interactions can give rise to a more complex, emergent phenomena. And this type of approach has been used throughout the study of ecology, to study different financial markets, in studying sociology, and here we're going to obviously use it as applied to biology. And a very simple example of an emergent system is if you look at Canadian geese, which we know by looking at individual geese, you can see, you know, they fly up in the sky. But lo and behold, when you put them together with other agents, other individuals in the sky, they tend to exhibit a more complex pattern, which in this case is the V flying formation that you can see here. That's just a very simple example of individual giving rise to an emergent property when it's around other agents. Okay, so a little bit more. This is a bottom-up approach. So we have simple rules that are governing individual agent behaviors, and this is what, in fact, generates those more complex systems-level outcomes. Sometimes this emergent phenomena can have somewhat non-intuitive properties, and that's where the interesting part comes in, that are maybe different than what you could predict just by looking at that simple agent. So if we look at the single goose flying, we would never know that when it's in the company of its peers, it also exhibits that V-shaped formation. usual motion of those cars is east to west, but the buildup of the traffic jam, the systems level property, is actually in the reverse direction. So if you thought about that long enough, you could probably figure it out. But that's an example of trying to get something that might be somewhat unintuitive at the first outlook. And the benefit is that agent-based approaches or agent-based models accommodate both spatially and temporally heterogeneous information, which of course is inherent to all tissues and of course, you know, plays out during the tissue patterning process. So everyone's got their favorite agent, here's mine. And if you've ever been to Charlottesville, Virginia, you know this is a behavior of an agent that's very typically seen there. So agents can be individual organisms, they can be individual cells, and that's the level that we're going to be operating on today. I've also seen agent-based models being used to approximate the behaviors of individual proteins within a single cell. So in terms of the biological scale here, I think it was shown on Monday that, you know, there's sort of a continuum starting out with genes all the way up to the hierarchy of, you know, higher level organisms. And what we're going to be focusing on today is sort of the molecules to cells to multi-cells range. So of course, agents maintain their own identity, but they interact, or I say behave, with other agents, and they do this based on a prescribed rule set. And then they, you know, make their own decisions based on the rule set on how they're going to behave in a particular situation to exhibit some type of behavior, and it's the aggregate of those decisions and behaviors that gives rise to the emergent phenomena. So the rule set, I'm going to go into this in a little more detail, but these types of rules can come from the literature, from published experimental values. They can come from hypotheses that you might wish to test. They can come from theories, just as some examples, and you'll see that in more detail when we start going into my research. So the basic algorithm is laid out here. So in our case, the agent-based simulation approach that we're using has basically two compartments. We have a stationary compartment, which is a sort of area, two-dimensional area that's discretized into pixels or patches, and you can see each one of these rectangles, we're sort of viewing it orthogonally now, represents a stationary pixel or sort of a patch. So you can imagine that those represent sort of the squares on the carpet here. And then on top of that, the second component is individual agents, which are capable of moving around, so they're mobile or motile, and these can kind of cruise around on top of the carpet from patch to patch and occupy that space and interact with their neighbors and acknowledge who they're next to and make decisions accordingly if it's prescribed in their rule set. So it's just a very simple example of how this works. Say at t equals zero, we have a particular perturbation in the environment. So say in this case, this cell over here is gonna die, so it becomes red. So then you might have a rule in your simulation that says, okay, if a cell next to me dies, then I'm also supposed to die. And so you can imagine what's gonna happen next. All the neighboring cells are going to die, and so they sort of change their states to a dead cell, and then you've incremented through one time course. So this is just a very simple example, but this is exactly how our simulations play out. Okay, so in more specifics now, we have our individual moving agents representing, each one represents one biological cell in the tissue, and these cells can have a lot of different attributes. They typically have 50 to 100 different variables, and these can denote things like the size of an agent, its age, so how long has it been since it divided, the location in the tissue, its phenotype, and I use that broadly to represent gene or protein expressions at given time points. It can have certain contact status, so it can know, for example, that it's next to, in this case, two different cells of maybe a like phenotype, or in this case, a like color, yellow. It can express, again, different proteins, different growth factors, integrins, coherins. These are all proteins that relate to its contact both with the cells around it and with the substrate that they're sitting on, so with the carpet that they're sitting on down here. It can have different cytoskeletal properties. They can have different metabolic properties. They basically can have any kind of property that you want to keep track of. You can program them to sort of keep track of that. The nice thing about doing agent-based modeling is that you can track these attributes over time, and so you can kind of go back in your simulation and do studies of cell lineage. So you can find out, okay, a cell ended up on the other side of the room, but how did it get there? What were the decisions it made along the way, and what were the states that it sort of occupied on its trip? The On the other hand, the stationary pixels can also, or the patches, these guys can also have their own set of variables that they keep track of. So we like to use these to store things like growth factor concentrations, for example. So we know that cells release growth factors and those diffuse out into the environment at both short distances and long distances, and those can elicit responses. And so that information can be stored as pixel variables. We can also store concentrations of extracellular matrix. Those are the proteins like collagen and fibronectin, which are sort of, they're acellular, so the proteins that are produced by cells, but they're grounded in that one spot, so they don't really ever move. They can change their concentration if cells produce more of them, but they stay in the same place. So like I said, those are typically stored as the pixel variables.
These are diffusible agents.
You can, well, we have...
growth factors are diffusible, maybe not concentrated. ECM proteins.
Right. So the growth factors are diffusible, and I'll talk about how that happens. The information of a concentration in a particular location is stored in a stationary point, but they can diffuse. So, for example, we can have a point source, say, under this cell, and then in time, that particular concentration or quantity can diffuse out to neighboring.
What do you mean by the information is stored in one point?
So I simply mean that the information about values of these different parameters can be stored spatially and temporally. So it'll make more sense in a second, I think. I'll come back to it if it's still not clear.
Just one quick thing. Can you give us an example of a cytoskeletal property that you would include?
So we haven't done that yet, but so I guess a particular stiffness of an actin molecule, for example.
An actin molecule or
this of the actin, a filament. This is an example. We haven't included that yet. I just showed this as something you could include if that was important to you.
It is.
Yeah, okay. We can do it. I see, yeah.
So the resolution that you would call it diffusing molecules would be on a much finer grid. Is it also going to be grid or is it continuously over this? The cells seem to be sort of hopping from one spot.
Right, it's a grid also.
It's a grid
point.
Also.
So it's discrete.
High resolution, so a cell can see a different concentration on its left and its right.
Sure. And it can, migrate accordingly if it's a chemotactic agent. Okay, so now we're going to take that orthogonal view and flip it up on end. So now we're just looking top down. And you can see our simulation space here. And each one of these little colored dots is an agent. And just to sort of foreshadow where we're going, this is supposed to be a simplified blood vessel network. So we have an arteriole here feeding into a capillary and then another capillary branching off of here. And these vessels are composed of endothelial cells, which are represented in yellow, and also smooth muscle cells, which sort of wrap around vessels, the larger vessels, and they're represented by these red cells here. You will notice that there isn't a lumen, so that's sort of an assumption that we've made for the time being, that we don't have channels, we don't have blood flow just yet, but I'll talk about how we're addressing that in the future. We also have a population of cells that's sort of scattered randomly throughout the simulation space. You'll see these blue cells are meant to represent interstitial fibroblast cells, and they're just kind of cells that hang out in the environment and we think play some pretty interesting roles when it comes to tissue patterning of the vasculature, and I'll get into that in a minute. But this is sort of the overall framework. So we set up our simulation space, or our tissue, again, it's two-dimensional. We apply a set of boundary conditions. These can be things like initial concentrations of growth factor in the environment, cell numbers, the tissue architecture. We have our cells responding independently from one another to this rule set, and I'll go into this in more detail in a minute. But what we get out of it is the coordinated tissue patterning, and from that we can derive various patterning metrics. So we can measure things quantitatively in terms of what the new pattern looks like and compare it back to the original one. So that's sort of the basic schematic of how this whole thing works. Now, before I go any further, I want to say that it's very important to us, especially with agent-based modeling, to do this really closely aligned with actual experimentation. And so what you're going to see, I'm going to go through basically three examples in our research where we've used agent-based modeling in tandem with experimental studies to try to provide insight into the questions that we're looking at. So this schematic just sort of depicts that. So we have the experimental model, and you're going to see a lot of pictures, images obtained from rats and mice. We have our computational model. The two direct each other as they're being developed. We do them, as I said, in parallel temporally. We do them at the same time. Usually the same student is working on both projects. Generate experimental data, which then allows us to verify our predictions, which is very useful to see if our aging-based models are remotely close to anything that we see in real life. And then we can also use our models to do some hypothesis testing and some hypothesis generation. So I'm going to give you an example of that in sort of the second portion of the talk. And ideally, we're definitely not there yet, but ideally the end goal is to develop computational simulations which will enable us to do rational design. So again, back to the tissue engineering motivation. If you want to develop a tissue engineered construct with a certain array of blood vessels with certain distributions of lengths and diameters and certain connectivities, then we might be able to eventually someday use a simulation to, in advance, sort of plan out how we might go about developing that or engineering that tissue. Okay, so the first examples relates to microvascular growth and remodeling. So this process is very important in human health today. It's related to diabetes, heart disease, cancer, pretty much any tissue, all tissues need a vascular supply, and in many cases where there's compromises in the tissue, the vascular supply is going to either contribute to that or recover that or play a part in some way, shape, or form. So in the disease realm, microvascular growth and remodeling, you've probably heard a lot about it in the news. There's been a lot of new drugs that have come out recently to target this process for the treatment of cancer, for example. So basically, I'm going to divide it into just two subsections. It's a very complex process, but I'm only going to focus on these two subsections. The first is angiogenesis, which is the process whereby if you have an existing blood vessel, it can give rise to new blood vessels through the process of capillary sprouting. So you saw a picture in the very first slide that had, I pointed out some little sprouts that were sort of budding off of an existing blood vessel network. Again, very important in tumor growth and formation. Tumors, once they get beyond a certain point where diffusion is not able to provide them with adequate nutrients, they need to develop their own vasculature, and so the process whereby they get that is called angiogenesis. Arteriogenesis is the next process, and this is important in heart disease. So this is the idea where if you have an occluded vessel, say you have an atherosclerotic plaque that is blocking a blood vessel channel, then what can happen is other existing channels that connect up to it can sort of take up some of the slack and actually enlarge. And this example is shown, this is a hind limb of a rabbit, I believe, where they have placed a ligature, a surgical ligature, or basically tied off a vessel so that the one, the ones around it would have to compensate by enlarging. And also this is down here just to show that this process can occur not just in pathological situations, but also during normal physiological growth and development. So every time you go to the gym, build that muscle mass, you're also creating angiogenesis and arteriogenesis in your muscles.
Could you explain the picture a little bit more? Like which vessel was tied off?
Yeah,
which one is changed?
Yeah, it's kind of confusing. I think the vessel, so basically this comes down, the blood flow comes down from your femoral artery, and it branches off here, and I think it was tied off in this case.
We're just looking at the little gray lines? Like this
gray,
big,
yeah, the little gray lines, exactly.
What are the big gray lines?
The big gray lines are bones.
Okay.
So this is an angiogram. That's how this was obtained, yeah.
Okay,
so that's sort of at the whole tissue level. At the cellular level, how these processes sort of manifest themselves is very detailed, and probably 30, 40 years of research has gone into trying to identify the cell behaviors and the factors, the proteins that elicit the angiogenesis and arteriogenesis responses. And so this is an drastic oversimplification of what's going on, but I just want to use it to point out both the structure of blood vessels, because that's going to be important, and also some of the behaviors that these cells undergo. So we have sort of a blood vessel coming along here, and in this case, all of our blood vessels are lined with endothelial cells represented in yellow, so they sort of, hug around each other and ring the vessels. And these endothelial cells have provided the right stimulus, and one example is vascular endothelial growth factor, which is a potent chemotactic stimulus that it's a potent mitogen for endothelial cells. It induces endothelial cell migration and proliferation, and so that plays an important role in angiogenesis, where we need those capillaries to sprout off developing vessels. And then we also have smooth muscle cells, which I showed before in red, and these are the cells that line or wrap around the outside of endothelial cells to provide structural support to the vessels, and they're also the cells that are responsible for regulating vascular resistance or vascular tone. So they're muscle cells, and they can actively constrict and then relax to regulate how much blood flow is going through a particular vessel. So the process that we're going to focus on today is how did the endothelial cells sprout and of what respond to VEGF, and of what significance does that have to angiogenesis, but also how do smooth muscle cells proliferate and migrate in the direction that the angiogenic sprout is growing so as to arterialize a vessel or enlarge it. And so we have a hypothesis, and others have hypothesized, that the origin of new smooth muscle cells is both from upstream smooth muscle cells that are resident in the vessel, and also from those blue cells I showed, those interstitial fibroblasts, that can receive cues to migrate and proliferate and sort of glom on to the vessels if provided with a certain stimulus. So this is sort of the biology that we're going to be talking about today. Now I'll talk about the specific way that we've tried to study this. So as I said, we use animal models all the time in the lab, and this is what it's called, a dorsal skin backpack chamber. And it sounds a little gruesome, but basically the idea is we take a rat or a mouse and we pull up the skin on its dorsum. So we basically make a dorsal fin, like a shark fin, on an animal. We excise the epidermis and the dermis on both sides of the fin to reveal the subcutaneous tissue underneath, which is very nicely vascularized, and you'll see a picture of that in a minute. And the benefit of using this particular model is we can keep this animal alive for up to 21 days, and just by putting it to sleep periodically and popping it under the microscope, we can take pictures of how its vasculature is growing and remodeling.
What happens after 21 days?
Well, the animal gets really angry, and basically the tissue, it's also, you know, a wound environment, so the tissue basically heals and prevents visualization, so it thickens and sort of undergoes this sort of fibrotic thickening, which impairs our visualization.
The screws, how do you decide how to tie them?
So they're actually, there's a spacer in between the two windows that limits the amount that we can tighten them down to. So that spacer defines the amount of force that's applied to that, yeah.
So if it takes 21 days for a wound to heal in a mouse, or? Because normally they heal.
Well, this is a rat, and it depends on the size, right? So this is 1 centimeter in diameter. And also, when we're imaging it, we image periodically, we're removing some of the granulation tissue to expose the vessel. So it's an environment that is very much in flux, you know, but that's kind of what we want. We want an angiogenic, wounded sort of environment so that we can see our new vessels. So here's an example of what the vessels look like under the microscope. So we can trace these out and directly incorporate them into our simulation. Now, I mentioned VEGF. It's a very well-studied factor in terms of eliciting capillary sprouting. And so what we wanted to do just to verify our model was to provide a point source of this growth factor. And so we do that by basically using alginate beads, which are on the order of 100 or 200 microns in diameter, which contain this particular protein, and we implant that into the tissue. And you can see an example of that here. Here's the bead, and here are the blood vessels. And so while the bead is in the tissue, the alginate's in the tissue, it's releasing this growth factor, this protein that's absorbed to the delivery device out into the tissue, and then the response is being generated that way. So we can do the exact same thing in our simulation, and here you can see our simulated bead has been placed sort of down in this corner. So the important thing to take home here is the idea that we can get initial conditions from our simulation that are actually obtained from real life in vivo experimentation.
What's the size of the pixels in the simulation?
So they're an order of 10 by 10 microns.
No, but that's meaningless in terms of that image. Or that simulation consists of like how many grids. I see the montage and the images in space. What is it in that simulation space?
So each one of these dots is 10 by 10 microns.
Ah, so each dot, okay, that's your pixels.
That's our pixel. Each dot is a pixel, and each one is 10 by 10 microns.
So, I'm sorry, so how many agents are within a pixel then? Just one?
Yeah, one cell occupies one pixel at any given time.
What are the blue green dots?
These guys?
Yeah.
These are the interstitial fibroblasts. They're these guys that hang out in the interstitial space, and we think they have a lot of functions, but one of the more interesting ones that we're interested in studying is the fact that they're the precursor cells for these perivascular cells, or these smooth muscle cells, which then later differentiate into active functioning contractile smooth muscle cells. So important, we think, in arteriogenesis. Okay, so for the rules, again, the simplified schematic, we have a lot of things going on, and one of them, as I showed, was the diffusion of a growth factor from a point source. And the rule that we use for this is just very simply the analytical solution of Fick's second law of diffusion in two dimensions, and that's shown here. We also have growth factors or proteins being produced and released by cells. So you can see that represented by this sort of green hue. You can see that the highest concentration is a lighter color, which sits sort of closer to the cells. And then as you go out away from the cells, it sort of, you know, turns darker and fades into black. And so that represents the gradient of a particular factor that's being produced by the endothelial cells. So the mechanism of this basically is shown here. We know from the literature that these cells can produce certain quantities of these factors at certain rates. And then we have a very simple algorithm, and it's basically that at certain amounts of, in certain time steps, an equal percentage is shared with each of the eight neighboring pixels. It's a very simple algorithm, because obviously solving diffusion in a complex geometry like this would be quite difficult. So big assumption there. But that's the best we can do right now. We have cell migration and proliferation rates, all obtained from published literature that we've manually curated. Cell differentiation rates, again, protein expression levels of different cells in response to different stimuli. And we also have a rule for cell death, which is basically, we know that cells don't like to really be crowded on top of each other in normal physiological states. And so if one cell gets surrounded by eight cells of its same cell type, it will basically undergo apoptosis or die. And so if you want more detail about these rules, it's all been published in 2004 in the FASCIV journal. All right, so I have a movie. Hopefully it'll come up here. Yeah, I have a movie of a simulation where we have our growth factor point source located right here, and that's releasing VEGF. And you're going to see the natural response of the endothelial cells is to sprout sort of in a way that's directionally focused, somewhat random, but somewhat directional towards the source. We also have the growth factor being released from the endothelial cells, and we have the smooth muscle cells, which are shown in red, sort of proliferating and migrating along the newly sprouted vessels. So this is that arteriogenesis process I referred to. And then last but not least, we have that interesting phenomena of these blue cells. You can see they're sort of dancing around, migrating around in the tissue. And the rule for their behavior is if they bump into an endothelial cell, they stick and they turn purple. So this is something that's been observed experimentally. And as I said, our hypothesis and others too, it's not been confirmed, is that these purple cells can eventually differentiate into the smooth muscle cells. So it's sort of a precursor cell type for this contractile smooth muscle cells.
Maybe I missed it, but how the fibroblast, the blue guys, respond to your growth factors when they're in the space? Do they do anything? They don't respond to the growth factors?
So they're not responding to the VEGF because they don't have the machinery to respond to that. They don't have the receptor for that particular molecule. But they are responding to the growth factor that's being secreted by the vessels. And so their response is a chemotactic response, so they're migrating in the direction of the highest of the gradient.
Is that a different species of growth factor then?
Yes. Yeah. So we have a total of four growth factors. One is the VEGF, and it's the only one that's released from the point source. And then, excuse me, three. And then two that are being released from the vessels, PDGF and TGF-beta.
So that's what I meant actually. You have like an aggregation of fibroblasts somewhere else on your vasculature already. Basically, since they respond to your new growth factor, then they would aggregate somewhat on the vasculature.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How that influence your
cell type that's associated with capillaries called a pericyte.
Yeah.
It's a stabilizer. I was wondering
yeah.
if you could clarify the relationship
I'm sorry.
Between that cell and some of these other
Absolutely.
Cells.
The purple cells are pericytes.
The purple cells
yeah.
are pericytes.
And so, and I'll come back to that in a minute. I should have
okay.
been more deliberate about that. So the purple cells, we call them pericytes, and they're basically thought to be a number of things. One is that they stabilize new capillaries. So a newly sprouted vessel, if it has a pericyte on it, then that's a stabilizing feature that'll prevent that particular vessel from undergoing regression. And then the other sort of attribute that they're associated with is a regulation of permeability. So we know capillaries filter fluids, and if they have, they can do it differently based on whether or not there are pericytes sort of hugging them. And I'll show a much more detailed picture of what these pericytes look at. But then the third sort of behavioral role that's attributed to them that's significant here is the fact that we think that they're precursors for smooth muscle cells. So they're immature smooth muscle cells. Yeah.
So does dimensionality matter? Because you have more overcrowding in 2D than it would be in 3D.
Yeah, that's true, and I'm sure it does matter. The only thing I'll say here is that the tissues that we study are by nature very thin. And so we're trying to use the approximation that, yeah, so there's differences in 3D, but at least we're close with the tissues that we're using to compare to experimentally.
I have just a silly question about the movie that where it looks like it sort of flashes and the colors change. Is that
yeah.
the step where the
yeah.
the growth factor is
being released?
So it's higher close to the
it's higher close to the vessel for those two growth factors, not for the VEGF. The VEGF is being released from the bead.
That doesn't look like a capillary. It looks like a big blob.
I know it does. Good observation. I'll get to that in a minute. That's a fantastic. So that's where
a
lot of
fat.
Oh, yeah, that actually looks like a tumor. So you wouldn't want to do that if you were going to be doing some tissue engineering.
Just a quick one. Why wouldn't you do it in 3D? I mean, especially if you have a sense weight. It wouldn't be that much more computationally intensive. So.
You're right. No, and we're working towards that. We're trying to do thin slice, absolutely. The software that we use, I'm not a software engineer. I don't have a background in computer science, and so I just used the tool that was easy to use, and I found it on the web. It's called NetLogo. And you can download it and play around with it. It's been out there. It's been in development probably for 6-7 years now. So the reason why we use it is because that's what we have. So how does this fare? The whole point. Is this a good prediction? And so, as I said, we can acquire these patterning metrics, which in this case mean total length density. So what is the length of total new vessels, total new endothelial cell? Vessels that we get. And so if we compare at day one, obviously they should be, you know, close or identical. At day 14, we see that there's a pretty good, you know, match, obviously, you know, same order of magnitude. That's the upside. The downside, as Charles so acutely observed, is the fact that they do look kind of like a bowl of spaghetti. And so something about the rules that we have in our simulation are not able to produce the emergent phenomena that is actually characteristic of the in vivo network.
What's the rules that you use for chemotaxis?
For endothelial cell chemotaxis?
Yeah.
So basically,
you've got it spreading all over the place, right? The point source is sort of diffusing in a Gaussian-like manner.
Right. The point source is diffusing out, and the endothelial cells at different thresholds of concentration that they see can undergo a more and more directed random walk, basically. So they're sort of doing this wiggle. It's like a random walk that's somewhat directed, and it gets more and more directed as they the location of the source.
No, I'm asking what bias is the random walk?
The concentration gradient of the factor that they're in.
Yeah, but how do you do that in a model?
So it's basically a probability type of rule that says at this threshold, you're more likely to go within 45 degrees of the highest concentration. At lower concentrations, you can wiggle around 180 degrees. So it's like a probability distribution.
What if you had an involved network here, like an extracellular matrix?
Yeah. Working.
Would that help to direct things?
You know, I don't think so, because in this particular, in these tissues that we're looking at, the extracellular matrix is so dense that it's like asking, does the orientation of the fibers in this carpet direct where I can walk?
Is it really that scale?
Yeah. In these tissues. People have studied on the smaller scale, sort of maybe back to that question, in terms of the wiggling, like endothelial cells sending out protrusions, and they tend to sort of do it on certain proteins. But when it plays out over the whole growth of the network, it's deemed, or it's thought not to be quite so important. And the person I can point you to, the research is that of Rich Price at UVA,
mm-hmm.
who's looked into that and integrated in other details.
But the ECM is going to have a scale of the cell, so.
Right,
you
but it's. No, right, but it's so dense. The ECM is so dense that the directionality doesn't matter. But certainly, the concentration could matter. And that's something that we've actually tried to put in. The other important aspect about the extracellular matrix is the fact that it can act as a sink for growth factors.
Mm-hmm.
And so we also think that that's very important. And we haven't added that yet.
Yeah, we had a lot of this a couple weeks ago in angiogenesis, the whole region.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Issues,
yeah, definitely. Those are very important. And like I said, we have the ability to incorporate it right now. It's just a matter of pinning down what rules we want to add. So in terms of the arteriogenesis, or the arterialization, I'm using those terms synonymously, basically we can measure the amount of new smooth muscle cells that we're getting. And so again, just a simple comparison, we see close agreement at day 14 between the in vivo measured amounts and the predicted amounts by the simulation. So this at least says with respect to that rule, we're probably somewhere in the ballpark, or I should say with respect to that set of rules, we're in the ballpark with predicting how smooth muscle cells can arterialize new vessels. I'm going to jump ahead and sort of keep the same system, but this is applied to another question that we have involving the potential use of human fat-derived or adipose tissue-derived stem cells or progenitor cells in enhancing this process. So the very simple idea that we can all relate to is obese patient comes into the hospital presenting with signs of angina or early-stage heart failure. Needs to have an enhancement of the blood supply perfusing their heart, so they've got plenty of adipose to spare. Let's do a liposuction, harvest the cells, inject them into the heart, and get new blood vessels. So that's sort of the big dream, right? We're not even close to that, and probably won't be within the next 10 years, but I'm just trying to use that as sort of a motivator.
Sorry, can I ask a quick question on this part?
Yeah.
So have you figured out a way to make the vessels like growth sort of look better in terms of the
Yeah, we think it involves adding more growth factors that control those things to a higher degree. So basically the tissue I'm going to be talking about here is not skin tissue. This is instead tissue, it's called the mesentery, which is a connective tissue in the small intestine. So it basically connects your guts together. It's very thin in the rat, it's only 100 microns thick, and you can see it splayed out nicely here. And the beautiful thing about it is it's so thin, it does really well with immunohistochemistry, so we can map out really nice, clean, clear vessels. So you can see this is a vascular network. Now in this case, we've taken some human fat from a liposuction patient, we've grown it in culture for a few days, we've labeled it with a dye, so some lipids in the membrane are labeled so that they fluoresce under fluorescent excitation. We inject these cells into the rat's belly, and then we come back at 10, 30, and 60 days later and try to track them, basically see where they end up. And so the human cells are shown in this yellow color, and they're scattered about here, and the green represents the rat's native architecture in its mesentery. And much to our surprise, we observed a phenomenon that we really didn't expect, and that was something about these human cells made them like to hang out on vessels. And so they started exhibiting these pericyte-like behaviors. So you can remember those blue cells, those teal cells in the simulation that would get called to the vessels. So that happens natively. But in this case, we're talking about human fat migrating to rat blood vessels.
Why are they eliminated by the immune system?
It's their immunocompromised rats. So they don't have blood.
I can make a suggestion as to why they hang out in those vessels.
Okay.
Fat is loaded with parasites because it's full of capillaries.
Yeah.
And that's, in fact, I think the so-called adipose-derived stem cell.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
Okay.
And I would love to talk about it more with you.
But
yeah.
That's also what happens if you take GLP cancer cells and deposit them in a tissue. All the rest of the cancer cells die and then
cell type. Now one can ask, what the heck does a human lung fibroblast have to do with a human adipose derived cell? And is that appropriate negative control? We don't know, but I will tell you that they don't do this behavior, whatever that means. So bottom line is they exhibit this behavior, and we think it's interesting because in the native tissue, we have parasites, which you can see here. So this is just native, native rat mesentery blood vessel, green cells of the native parasites, and you can see they do look pretty similar. And in that role, as I alluded to before, we think they're interesting because they provide support to newly formed vascular channels. So they do, in fact, increase vascular length density at day 10 compared to lung fibroblasts, and at the late time point, too, significantly compared to the injection of just a vehicle control or no cells. You do see increases in vascular length density. Now, what's going on at day 30? I have absolutely no idea, and I'd love to talk about it if any of you have ideas, but basically, this data has been substantiated by a number of other studies that have used different models of vascular impairment where they've injected human fat-derived cells and seen full, partial or full recovery of these tissues, which would normally become completely necrotic. So just by having human fat cells in a tissue that's impaired, there is some vascular benefit. So.
When you measure the length, did you look at the same region every time? I'm just thinking of volumes.
So no, in this case, we have to harvest the tissues. We have to sacrifice the animal to obtain a time point. So this is collected from different animals. So we weren't able, like in the previous experiment, to do serial images.
Right.
So these are.
So we cannot compare this one, right?
No.
Say why there's a decrease in that.
No, you really can't, because each one of these data points is taken from a different animal that we had to kill to get that data point. Okay, so back to the modeling thing. Our question, why do they home? Why do they do this? Why do they glom onto the blood vessels in pretty high percentages, between 30 and 50% or 60%, depending on the type of cell, depending on the patient's age, the patient's sex, the fitness of the patient, their BMI, and various other aspects. You know, different people have different quality fat, shall we say, when it comes to.
But this is still, you're taking it from the person and putting it in the rat.
Yeah.
But depending on
donor.
Characteristics of the donor.
Yeah. So basically, old people's fat doesn't grow blood vessels as good as new people's fat, or young people's fat, to put it simply.
What about the same age, different fitness levels?
We haven't looked into that yet.
Fat.
Yeah, no, you know, we haven't looked into that. A lot of people are starting to.
Another kind of question. So when you look at these percentages, so it's possible that the fat has lots of different cell types in it.
It does.
Right?
Definitely.
Okay, it does. And so when you're looking at these percentages, you don't know which cell types are hanging around after 60 days or not.
We don't know.
Of the ones that are there at that time, where are they?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And those are experiments that we're in the process of doing, characterizing them and trying to isolate prospectively which are the ones that are doing it or enrich for them. So there's a lot of production going on that.
But you are pulling out the adipose-derived stem cells, though.
No, well, I shouldn't. These are I can go into the details of how we extract them, but these are referred to as, used to be called stromal vascular fraction. So these are the cells which will basically sink in a column. So they're plated, so they're adherent. So maybe they're adherent cells. So we call them loosely. I'm calling them stem cells, but they really should be referred to as stromal cells.
Yeah.
So there's a mix, definitely a heterogeneous mix.
So you float out the fat.
Yeah.
And one more sort of weird question. Do you know what a lymphoma is?
A lymphoma?
Lymphoma.
Lymphoma?
Yeah, it's there's a friend of mine has this. I would never remember.
It's a bad term for
it's,
yes.
It's a perfect term for it because some people get lumpy. They get these like benign, like they're pretty much fat tumors that make them look a little bit like cauliflower. And it occurred to me that there might be a connection between, because they do have to vascularize.
Yeah.
But the word lump and oma, they're just both parts mean the same.
Oh.
Yeah. Lump, lump. It's a lump lump. So to try to figure this out, we just did a very simple, this is where I'm going to answer the hypothesis. The hypothesis, using the models to pose hypotheses and see if they're even feasible and worth pursuing, worth spending your time in the lab to follow through on. So we just hypothesized here a random walk. So we populated our tissue space with these pink cells, which represent those human adipose And as it turns out, when we just allow them to random walk, simple rule, random walk, and if you see a vessel stick to it, we see a lower percentage than we actually see in vivo. So this suggested to us that maybe, like the native fibroblasts, these cells have the machinery to respond to a chemotactic agent. So maybe there's something that's released from the vessels that the cells are responding to and causing them to migrate towards them. And so we went back to the lab and we laid out our list of candidate molecules that are known to work in this way with regards to the vasculature. And we did some flow cytometry to try to look for them on our population of human adipose cells. And lo and behold, there was one in particular that showed up in 99% of our cells. And so now, for those of you who are interested, it's PDGF-beta receptor, which is also known to be involved with native pericyte recruitment. So we do think that maybe there is a link there. But just an example of how we actually use the model to maybe test something first with the click of a button, which then we could follow up on in lab. So I'm going to switch gears again. I'm going to stick around with the progenitor cell story as it relates to angiogenesis, but I'm going to talk about our native bone marrow-derived stem cells and vascular growth. So these are the cells that reside in our bone marrow and are known to be recruited to sites of injury and tissues remotely where they can play an active role in enhancing the angiogenic process. And so to study this, we have a very simple model. We take green fluorescent mice where GFP is constitutively expressed, and we harvest their bone marrow cells, and then we take a wild-type recipient mouse, and we irradiate that animal, and then we basically reconstitute their bone marrow by injecting the GFP-derived or GFP-expressing bone marrow cells, and then what we get is mice where anytime you see a green cell, you know it had to have come from the bone marrow. So we take these mice and we put them in an environment which is known to stimulate angiogenesis. And basically that's just putting them in a hypoxic environment. So we put them in a little plexiglass chamber where they live basically at 10% oxygen for the duration of their stay. And then after 21 days, we harvest the muscle tissue and we take a look at it.
Do you inject the GFP11 cells with in this muscle or in the
We do intravenously,
in
the tail vein injection. So it homes to the bone marrow, takes up residence, proliferates, and then you reconstitute the entire bone marrow with the green cells. And so here's what happens. So this is the third tissue I was going to talk about. It's the muscle, spinal trapezius muscle in the back of the mouse now, not rat. We switched species there. So again, great thing about the mouse spinal trapezius muscle is it's very thin, so you can do nice immunohistochemical staining procedures to fluorescent, make all the blood vessels fluorescent, so you can see all these red fluorescent vessels here. And lo and behold, after 21 days, we do in fact see green cells, which means there were cells coming from the bone marrow. Now,
what are the other stripes?
These stripes are muscle fibers,
okay.
So they autofluoresce. They're not labeled with anything, but they just naturally give off fluorescence, so that's why you see them. And what's interesting about tissue patterns while I'm on the subject is that you can see there's this sort of orientation of that vessels along the muscle fiber. So it's a point I didn't bring up, but it's important to note that different tissues will inherently have different tissue patterns because of their other structures like a muscle fiber. So the questions pertaining to this, what are the dynamics of the homing process? So how long does it take those green cells to get there? How do bone marrow cells find the injured tissue? So what are the mechanisms that are sort of calling out to them to pull them from the circulation? What do they do once they get there? So we think they somehow benefit angiogenesis, but we're not sure. And then what molecular mechanisms are regulating this entire process? So to get at this, we thought it would be worthwhile to build a model that, again, starting with our agent-based simulation, we can take pictures of our networks and get sort of real networks. You can see them laid out here. So we have an inflow, and then we have inflow through the arteriole. We have our capillary channels, and then they're branching, and then the outflow through the venule.
And so you made that by hand?
Yeah, basically,
okay.
Yeah. So you just trace it out, yeah. And then, now in this case, we're talking about circulating cells. So what does that mean for our simulation? Well, prior to this point, we hadn't incorporated any blood flow, right? I told you those cells didn't have any lumens, and there was no blood flow. Well, we can't hold off on doing that any longer if we want to study circulating cells. So what we've done here is created an interface with a finite element analysis approach that allows us to calculate blood flows throughout the whole network and relay those flows patient-based model where we have all of our nice individual cell behaviors, relaying information into a fluid flow model that gives us calculation of flows and pressures through each vessel. And then again, what we can get out is the emergent properties. So this is sort of a schematic of how it works. And let's see, I think I have a movie of this happening. So yeah, here you can see some cells. They're flowing in here, this artery, they're flowing in this arterial, cruising through the capillaries, and then draining out through the venule. And again, all of this flow is determined by the pressures that can be measured, or in this case, that are prescribed, that are known at the inlets and the outlets. And then if we change the pressure, let's see. Yeah, for some reason. So here's another case where we've changed the pressure. So we've, I think, 10 millimeters of mercury here, 10 millimeters of mercury here, and 5 here. And you can see we've reversed the flow direction. So now the cells are flowing from here. So yeah, different flow conditions. So in the first simulation you saw in the first movie, 40 millimeters of mercury here, 30 here, 10 here. So we had the flow going here, up and around. We had here, up and around, and then here and around. And then when we switch the pressures, basically we get a reversal of flow. So we have flow coming in here, going out through here, and flow coming in here, going out through there.
But why wouldn't?
What's that?
Why wouldn't you do that?
No, it would. I'm not. There's nothing fancy about this. I'm just saying that we can do it now. And that information is actually real. So we have real flows that can now affect, say we have a rule in our simulation that says when endothelial cells are exposed to a different flow pattern, then they do something different phenotypically. Say they start expressing a certain protein. So before we couldn't do that because we didn't really know what the flows were, but now we have the flows and they're sort of, I mean, it's a model still, but they're, you know, at least within the realm of possibility, and they can be dynamic. So we could have, for example, say we get a capillary sprout here that comes and connects here, then we could incorporate that into the finite element analysis model. So we'd have a new element here through which we have flow, and that model could calculate for us how that affects the pressure and flow distribution in the whole network, and that could update here. So we can have this back and forth where we have the update of the actual flows as we have dynamics changes in the agent-based simulation.
Yeah, this is really good because in the week's discussion about angiogenesis, nobody mentioned that any of these endothelial tubes have blood in them. And in models or in cell culture. And one of the questions that we all kind of had was, how does flow actually help to induce that sprout? And with a sprout that actually has pressure in it, and then you get to mechanosensitization,
right,
and all the signals are different associated with that too.
Exactly.
So you're really on track in adding this physical forces in here.
Yeah. I'm sure you're well aware of the other stuff that goes on in our apartment. So if I wanted to collaborate with my neighbors, I need to do some endothelial cell mechanobiology.
Just go see Tom.
Yeah. All right, so how much time do I have? Like 2 minutes? So what does this really do? Well, I don't want to show any like hard and fast results here because this is still pretty new. But basically, I'm just going to show that what it adds to just doing the experimental approach alone is the fact that we can get dynamic information. So we can actually track sort of, how many cells are, how many of these green cells, the ones that are getting out of the tissue, how many of those are accumulating, and what does that profile look like in space and time? Whereas with the experiment, we just have the 21-day time point picture, right? Because we have to, again, harvest the animal to get the image. So here we're able to sort of use the model to fill in the blanks with our data, which is helpful. And then, how are we doing with this right now? Well, the simulation predicts around 4 cells, both in the control and the hypoxia. 4 cells get out of that initial network that I showed you, this guy, over 21 days. 4 of our fancy schmancy stem cells, circulating cells. In the experimentally measured case, we see 13 in control and 9 in hypoxia. So it's really didn't say much, only that we're kind of on the same order of magnitude, which we're thrilled about. And
I don't know how you translate from your at the time from your simulation.
So, well, it's just keeping track. So in our simulation, everything is on a clock, right? All the rules are rolling as according to the rules. So such and such happens, cell proliferates every 24 hours, right? So we have a clock, and so we can just go and look and see at each time point. We can have the simulation output data. After one day, what does it look like? After 2 days, what does it look like? Whereas we can't do that with animals, we'd have to sacrifice it.
What's the rule for transmigration?
Not at this point in time, it's very rudimentary. So it's basically, I have to go back and look at the details, but it's like there's P-selectin, or there's like basically one ligand that has to do with, rolling and capture, and then there's another ligand receptor pair that has to do with transmigration. So it's just, basically it's a probability expression, you know, how many of our cells would express this protein at a certain threshold, and if that threshold's exceeded at a certain endothelial cell, and if one of our stem cells rolls across at that, when it's being exceeded, then it comes through and goes into the extra, the interstitial space.
Yeah, it's always, it's sort of deterministic, right? I mean, if that threshold is exceeded, it happens. It's
right.
Not, if that threshold is exceeded, there's a better chance it happens, or something like that.
Right.
It's not a, really not a stochastic model. Is that right?
It's more deterministic than stochastic.
Yeah.
This one, definitely,
yeah.
Yeah. And like this is very rudimentary. It's still really in developmental stages. Okay, so just to wrap up then, I've kind of tried to show how it's useful to sort of pursue this idea of testing and contrasting, perhaps alternative hypotheses. So just to illustrate this, say you might have three different hypotheses, you try them out in your model, and it looks like one of them really seems to match your data better, so that's the hypothesis then you're going to kind of try to pursue and figure out ways to actually test in the lab bench. And then also useful for generating new hypotheses, and I say that simply because the process of building these models requires you to think about what's going on in biology at such an intimate level that you really, you are, thinking, how are these cells acting, what are they responding to, what are the behaviors they're making, and so, not much, sometimes you run into places where they really don't know, so, you have to come up with some hypotheses, so. Limitations. Only as good as the rules you input. Obviously, that's a big limitation with agent-based modeling. How do you know when to stop adding rules? I mean, you can go by Occam's razor principle, right? And just only add enough until you can explain what you're looking at. The scaling can be very technically challenging. Defining your agent unit can actually limit you to a certain extent to the conclusions that you can draw. So in our case, we have each agent was a cell. In terms of the refined activities that are going on inside the cell, we're not quite there yet. We're actually working towards that. We're trying to develop sort of an interface where we can talk to people who do gene network reconstructions and kind of get down to the level of where the previous talk was and try to interface the two so that we have a lot of sophistication on the single cell level, but then that can be scaled up across hundreds of cells. So that's kind of where we're going. And then, of course, the last point, biological tissues are obviously 3D, so we're trying to work towards that as well and develop some 3D simulations that will enable us to do the same thing, but in a more realistic manner. Tactics for ABM, I just want to refer you to Volker Grimm, who is, I would say, probably one of the leading investigators in the field of ecology that applies agent-based modeling, and he just got a paper out in Science, and if any of you are interested in pursuing this at all, I would refer you to read both that, and also he's got a new book out, which I'm happy to show you later. But basically, his idea is that agent-based models in and of themselves can kind of lead you astray or perhaps be difficult to derive real information out of. However, if you confine them by taking into consideration observed patterns, really using these observed patterns to your advantage, your agent-based models are going to be more structurally realistic. And so this is sort of a paradigm that we've come to from a different angle, but we're both now, Dr. Grimm and I are kind of at the same place. And so I do think it's important that when you're considering agent-based models, that the patterning effect is really an important consideration there, and you can use it to your advantage. Long-term goal, to do prospective design, as I said, this is just by way of summary. Specifically, we're interested in vascularization, but I have done some collaborative work with a cell biologist, again, Doug Simone at the University of Virginia, who works very closely with Ray Keller, and we've applied our agent-based modeling techniques to the blastocoel roof thinning process, and I'm happy to talk about that, and there's also a publication in Developmental Biology from last year as well, if you're interested. It talks about that. And then finally, I just want to acknowledge this is my lab. We're about 2 years old. Got some great students that, like I said, they're all doing modeling and experimental work hand in hand. My collaborators in cell biology, plastic surgery, very generous with the human fat although I will say it's quite abundant in Virginia. And then my collaborators